This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps, and each week with an inspiring guest, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. So, here we go. This week, we're talking all about eating disorders and OCD with an incredible campaigner who I got in touch with via his work with Sea Change. And if you're not already aware, Sea Change is Ireland's national campaign for ending mental health stigma. It's a wonderful organization that is very much informed by people with lived experience of mental health, like today's guest. And so in his work with them, Owen is an ambassador, which means he shares his experience, shares what he's learned, shares his understanding of stigma and why it's so important to take down. And of course, this all leads to him being a particularly ideal guest for this here show. Also, he was one of the men featured in a documentary called Unspoken, which was broadcast on RTE and is still available via their catch-up service. A VPN would probably be the best option to get access to that if you are not here. And if you've been listening to the show for a while, you'll remember that Owen is actually the second person I'm interviewing from the Unspoken documentary, having previously spoken to Daniel O'Boyle. And I'll include details of that episode in the description if you want more. For now, though, we'll get into this conversation, which we covered a lot. I related massively to Owen's experience, and it was a really warm and affirming conversation for me. We even have that thing in common of being very focused in on language around mental health and how important that is when it comes to stigma. I resisted the temptation to go down a rabbit hole of that being the rest of the episode. But for now, though, we'll get on to all the conversation we did have. And also, if you want more information on Sea Change, their wonderful work, I will include that in the episode description as well. We've got more coming up with them to look forward to as well. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
My name is Owen Kernan. I'm 40 years of age and I'm living in Dublin. When I think back to the earliest thing that has, I suppose, played a part in my life with regard to mental health is something that I only came to learn in recent times. I didn't recognize it at the time, but as a young kid, I had many OCD behaviors that my parents probably didn't recognize were an issue. And that's just Owen. He just likes cleaning his hands. Or that's just Owen. You know, he likes to, you know, worry about particular things or obsess over particular things. But they didn't necessarily know that that was something to do with mental illness. I don't give out to them for that because that's all they knew at the time. And that's, you know, our parents do the best they can do for us in most cases with what they know at that moment in time. Nowadays, we know different. Nowadays, we know, you know, in hindsight that they were OCD behaviors and maybe they could have been treated slightly differently. But at the time, they did their best. And so that's all I can ask for. And that's all I would try to do myself is, you know, do the best for the person with the knowledge that I have right at that moment.
That's a very fair and compassionate way of looking at it. And when you think back on before knowing what these were symptoms of, how did you deal with the stress around, you know, these compulsions, these thoughts of behaviors you felt compelled to do?
Well, I was quite young at the time. So I don't think I even recognized them myself, and I didn't even recognize the stress that they brought. For me, it was just a way of life. I did these particular compulsions because of certain obsessions I had in my head, but I didn't recognize even myself that that was an issue. I'm talking age of anywhere from, you know, starting probably around 7 or 8 years of age, maybe even a little bit earlier, and then growing into my teens. And you could probably also associate them with, you know, just the change in us as humans, the change in, you know, in puberty and, you know, growing that little bit older, starting to see the world in a different way. You know, it could be all associated with that as well. But now when I look back and I now understand truly what OCD is, I see that that's what they were, you know, superstitious thoughts, thoughts, you know, around contamination, you know, various different things. And I've carried them right through to today. And that's how I know what they were. You know, if they had stopped or, you know, if they had fallen out of my life, maybe, in my late teens, early 20s, I wouldn't have ever known that they were OCD, that's why, or that's what was behind it. But nowadays, because that's part of my life, I can look back and see that they were.
Yeah.
And OCD it's the great shapeshifter. Mm-hmm. You know, it finds your greatest weakness and it plays on that. And then when you sort that weakness or you find the strength to deal with that weakness, it'll find the next one. It will constantly find what is that little nugget that it can latch onto and play games in your head with. So, you know, it takes a huge amount of work to, first of all, recognize it.
Yeah.
And second of all, then even try and figure out how do you combat it or how do you live with it in a quieter fashion. That's about all I can do at times, live with it in a quieter fashion. But I can see where it's like waves on the sea. You know, there's peaks and there's troughs and there's times when it's really strong. And I will have many, many obsessive thoughts and many, many compulsive behaviors as a result. But then there's times when it'll be a little bit easier. And that could be throughout a day. That could be out of a 24-hour period. That could be throughout a 31-day month. That could be throughout a 12-month year. You know, it's constantly evolving. It's constantly changing. I feel guilty for it sometimes because I do look for quite a bit of reassurance from my partner. And I often say to her, I know I drive you mad with these questions. I know I drive you mad with these reassuring behaviors. But you know what? You kind of have to sometimes pick your battles. And at the moment, OCD is not my battle. OCD is something I can live with. It's a bit of a pain in the ass at times. It causes me to have quite an extensive bedroom routine to get into bed at night and lengthy period of time. But you know what? It's not killing me. It's not doing something that is causing me to be suicidal. It's not doing something that is causing me to be malnourished. It's not doing something that is going to send me to an early grave right now. There's bigger battles. You kind of have to prioritize what do I want to work on today? Because mental health and mental illness and the work that goes into, you know, dealing with, you know, those challenges and dealing with being able to live with whatever the diagnoses you may or may not have are, takes a huge amount of work, and a lot of emotional energy. And we don't necessarily recognize the drain that it can have on our emotional energy. So, you know, we got to be fair to ourselves as well and say, look, you know, we can't solve everything right now. So let's pick out the right things, get them right, and then move on.
Yeah, there's a lot of difficult realizations to come to there, but I think they are so important. Like acknowledging just how draining living with mental illness is, I think is so vital, because otherwise that then becomes another part of the problem. It becomes another stick to beat ourselves with of, oh, I, you know, woke up feeling awful today. I therefore maybe didn't achieve as much. And then I feel awful that I didn't achieve as much and I'm still tired. And how dare I be tired? You know, it can escalate for us. That is part of the answer there, that feeling this way, navigating that is exhausting on its own. That's a job. That's a task.
It is. But there's also another side to that as well, which I think is really important to recognize. And this only comes with work that you might put in with a good therapist or the work you might put in, you know, through whatever intervention you're involved in. And that is to recognize that sometimes it's okay to have a positive day too.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not going to cause your mental illness to disappear straight away. And that might sound a bit strange, but where I'm coming from with that is, and this is more directed to people who aren't living with mental illness, because I think someone with mental illness will get this, but someone without it may not understand that my eating disorder, my OCD, my anxiety, at times is my best friend. At times is the only thing in the world that I can trust. And it's the only thing in the world that I feel I can control, for example. And if I have a good day and someone sees me having a good day, I get worried then all of a sudden that, oh, does that mean there's expectations going to arrive? That Owen is feeling a little bit better? Does that mean his mental illness is disappearing? Does that mean he's going back to normal? In their words, in inverted commas, does that mean that all the expectations of what life is supposed to be like for a 40-year-old man in Ireland right now are going to be, you know? So I have to do a lot of learning to understand that it's okay to have a good day too.
Mm-hmm.
And that people aren't all of a sudden going to jump on top of you and go, we're all right, Owen. Well, now, do you know what? You've had a good day, so I'm going to expect you to run a 26-mile marathon tomorrow. That's not the case. You can just have a good day and then tomorrow it could be a crap day again. And that takes a bit of work as well, you know. So while it's recognizing that the work you need to do on, you know, on your mental health and, you know, treatment for mental illness is exhausting, it can also be fun as well.
Yeah, I love that. Absolutely. I'm someone that also has had a lot of counselling, and yeah, much of it has been really tough and many times have been really enjoyable. And I've been so excited to tell people about realisations, which is always fun because you go to a level of depth with counselling where sometimes the realisations you're having are entirely unrelatable for other people. You're like, so I had this thought about this other thought and then this thought, and they equal this. And they're like, huh? To say the first one again? But I relate, having been, you know, in a lot of those same places, I relate a lot to that, where you can at times feel like mental illness is the one consistent thing in your life. And so there is that balance of, there is actually a lot that we can learn via it, but there is a line between finding that versus giving in to certain things it might be telling us. And I think what you said earlier, where you described how OCD will find your weakness, has been a big part of myself and a lot of people figuring that out, that sometimes we need to personify this thing because it's in our head, so much of it. You know, so many of OCD, for example, those thoughts are rattling around with your regular thoughts. And so trying to find, okay, what is me? What is it? To what extent is it a part of me? And to what extent am I going to allow it space here and control?
That's it, exactly. And it's the same with an eating disorder. You know, an eating disorder and OCD are like brother and sister, in that, you know, the behaviors, while there's, I suppose, a number of different variations of an eating disorder in terms of behaviors, they are all sort of interconnected in that idea of control as well. And that's what OCD is. It's control. And all of this control is nothing to do with power. You know, it's nothing to do with wanting to be God Almighty and you know, be the most important person in the room. It's actually about feeling like you are the smallest person in the room and wanting to feel safe as a result. And so you are trying to find that little bit of control and that little bit of safety that you can say, well, I don't know what that person across the table is thinking of me. I'm in my head, I'm thinking that they think I'm crap, that they think I'm, you know, no good, that they think I'm, you know, worthless and no value. So I can't control their thoughts, but I can control whether I feel that I look good because the number on the scales dropped today.
Yeah, that is so beautifully articulated. And we live in a world where so much of that is externally shown to us from a very young age. So when we're feeling that vulnerability and we are, yeah, grasping for a better feeling of safety, then something like, well, at least if they look across the table and I'm thin, then that's something. Or that I'm clean, if maybe that's a crossover for some people's OCD. There can be these things we latch on to of, I feel unsafe, I feel scared. What's anything? You know, so it's no coincidence to me that, yeah, so often that is appearance for people. That is one of the first things we judge about others. And it's something that we are encouraged to judge through so much of our media. And
I think, sorry to interrupt, but just to you know, that idea of how it's damaging is when I developed my eating disorder, I was a very active water sports person. And not just going out for a swim, but I mean, you know, good, heavy, not extreme water sports, but, you know, kite surfing, stand up paddleboarding, different things like that. And I got into my head that the less I weighed, the better a kite surfer I would be. Now, what I didn't add into that was the less I weighed, the less muscle mass I would have, the less strength I would have. And I'm not talking about being a bodybuilder. I'm actually just talking about being able to lift my shoes off the floor, you know? And so you get into this messed up scenario of the weaker I become, the more I think I will be better. And that's in my scenario. I can't speak for someone with, you know, binge eating disorder. I can't speak for someone with bulimia. I never had those behaviors. For me, it was very much around restriction. It was orthorexia to start with, and then that developed into anorexia. And for me, that was, when I look back in it now, the weird scenario of, I wanted to be as good as the other people around me involved in these activities, but I put myself in a position where I was actually weaker physically after a period of time. So how was it ever going to work? You know, how was it ever going to have a positive result? But at the time, if all you feel you can't control, because it's the only thing that you believe in your head, you can't hear other people's thoughts. You can't hear what they say in real life behind your back. So you project into them what you think it is they're thinking or what you think it is they're saying. And that causes you then to try and find that sense of control in other ways.
Yeah, absolutely. I relate to that a lot with my own experiences. And it is really difficult to describe to people because, you know, oftentimes when you're in the absolute midst of it, you don't see anything that resembles reality. A lot of the time when I interview people with experience of eating disorders, they describe these experiences and how they'll find themselves twisting it. Someone says, you know, Daniel, for example, talks about someone would say he looked well, and he would take that as I look fat. And, you know,
I'm nodding my head in, you know, the listeners won't see this, but my head is going up and down, very high and very low, with massive agreement in what you've just said.
Yeah.
In that hugely, and triggering is such a cliched word, but it is the best word to use. That triggering sense of, oh, you look great. Oh, does that mean that I look fat?
Well, this is it. And I wanted to pause on that in particular, because I think it's one of the reasons why recovery can be very difficult and very difficult for other people to understand. Because sometimes as we're coming out of it, our awareness can be getting better, but it's a slow road. And along that, we can find all kinds of ways to subvert.
Absolutely. And, you know, sometimes it's not even to do with the other person or another individual in your life. Sometimes it's still within your own head. I talk to my therapist quite a lot about it nowadays around this idea of, imagine having a fishing rod stuck to your back, coming up over your head and pointing out over in front of your face and dangling down around you are a number of hooks. And as you're walking along, these hooks are continually in front of your face. They don't ever hook you, only on some very unexpected and unusual occasions when you least, you know, you least anticipate. I can give you two very clear examples. One is recently I went out for dinner and, you know, I hadn't up to that point really been able to go out for dinner very, very much since becoming ill. And myself and my partner went out. It was very simple. We just said we'd go to a nice, easy restaurant and we'd just try and have a nice little meal or whatever. The menus were presented to us and the very first thing I saw was calorie numbers on the menu. Now, in all of my treatment, I had been taught and learned and accepted that calories were units of fuel. They were coal, you know, that you put on the fire and the fire burns inside in your belly and then you add more coal. That's how the whole system works. But I'd had a period of time where I hadn't really talked about this, or I hadn't really had this, you know, as a priority in my treatment conversation, let's say. So I'd kind of forgotten that a little bit. So I'm sitting in this restaurant and I'm looking at this menu and I get hooked onto the calories and I can't look at anything else. And I end up ordering the thing that has the least calories on the menu because, again, I was looking for that sense of control and safety because I had forgotten what I had been told otherwise in terms of what else I could trust. So that's a kind of a clear example of where you really have to keep practicing, have to keep working and keeping it in the forefront of your mind. Everywhere you go or every opportunity you can, try and reinforce that message for yourself. Otherwise, though, you know, those little hooks can catch you. The other one is recently I was sailing in a competition and there was a beautiful photo taken of myself and the two others that I was sailing with in the boat that we were in. And it's quite a, you know, quite an exciting looking photograph. We're coming down off a wave. You know, it looks well. And, you know, it's, there's lots of energy and coolness in it, if you want to use that phrase. But when I saw it, I couldn't see anything other than what I saw that I looked like in that image. My body image became really negative very quickly as soon as I looked at that image. And again, I couldn't get past that. And I still look at that image. I was just looking at it before I came on with you today. And I still, that's the very first thing I go to. I can move away from it eventually, but the immediate thing that I focus on is how am I looking in that image? Not Jesus, oh, you're doing an activity there that you couldn't have done 4 years ago because of the way you had treated your body, because of the way you had, you know, restricted yourself to the point of severe illness. So again, you've got to come back and you've got to go, right, let's think about this. You know, what did I learn? I learned that I re-nourished my body. I've now got it back to a point where it's stronger. It's able to do things again. It's able to allow you to get out and get sailing.
I just wanted to add really what you said there. I so agree. Those behaviors are so easy to fall back into. And, you know, recognizing them and how much we have to relearn is such a big part of the process. Because I know for me, certainly a lot of it had been relearning your body isn't the enemy. And instead, it's a tool, it's an asset, it's kind of the greatest machine you'll ever have. And we only get one. So are we going to look after it? Or are we going to abuse and neglect and villainize it? And that's still something I have to remind myself. And I think that analogy you gave of the fuel is a really great way of reminding yourself of that, of like, the food is for a purpose. Even if you don't want the food is necessary. It is needed. And now you're in a place where you have so much of this awareness. Could we trace back a little bit to where your symptoms were developing with your anorexia, the orthorexia, and also the OCD? And what was the process like of becoming aware of what was going on for you?
So to come back to that period in my life, I go back to the end of 2018. I was 35 years of age, just going 36. And I was living what I considered to be the model of life. You know, I was happily in a relationship with my partner, Carolina. We had been living in Dublin for many, many years. I was on what I felt was a relatively good path with work and business and that kind of thing. We were, you know, the idea of family was floating around and, you know, having kids and things like that. We were renting, but, you know, hearing, you know, make sure you buy soon and this kind of thing. So there was a lot of external pressures coming on in, let's say, prior 2018, maybe 2013 onwards, you know, for the previous 5 years. You know, need to start thinking about a family, need to start thinking about a house, need to start thinking about what are you really doing with work. And I didn't feel like that there was anything unusual in that, because that's what you hear in the media. That's what you hear in the world is, you know, 2.47 children. Or I'm not sure if that's still a number anymore, but it was at a time where, you know, that was the perfect family. And, you know, you had the house and you had the business and you had the family and all those bits and pieces. But we were nowhere close to that. And that, I think, was creating the pressure cooker inside me. I was not aware at the time, but it was. In hindsight, I can see that. So end of 2018, my business is kind of starting to float away a little bit. It's not doing so good anymore. And I'm not feeling hugely worthy in the world. I'm not feeling great when I'm beside peers and friends on the beach, you know, in terms of water sport. And I'm not feeling great within my family scenario because I'm hearing things from my parents and hearing things from external family members around, you know, where are you going with your life? So what I decided to do was I decided to clean up my life. And I use the word clean there very specifically because I decided to go on an orthorexic journey, which at the time I didn't realize was orthorexia, but now I see that. And that involved, I won't go into all of the behaviors, but it involved a huge amount of restrictive behaviors. Mm-hmm. Orthorexia is all around clean eating. It's all around knowing the provenance and the purity and, you know, not taking anything into your body that could be, you know, a danger or could be dirty, in a word.
Yeah. And just to add to that, because many of our listeners may not be as familiar with that one as other conditions, there's an important distinction there in terms of like the extremeness of the behavior, right? That it's taking what could be, you know, explainable and agreed upon as a healthy behavior, but pushing that to an extreme where not only is it no longer healthy, but also the level of obsession required to be that restrictive is in itself a dangerous behavior. And this is one that isn't yet a diagnosable mental illness, but I, you know, strongly suspect it will become its own one because in some ways it feels easier to fall into, as you described there, this idea of like clean living. It's a phrase that is bandied around in a way that I never remember when I was younger. And there is a version of that where you're conscious with what you eat. You try and make some healthier choices here and there versus every single thing I consume needs to be obsessively focused, restricted, and minimized in a way where I guess a lot of the key is there's no end goal. There's no diet that's acceptable. It's how do I push this further and further and further?
Yeah, you've hit it right there. I didn't have an end goal with my orthorexia. I just knew I needed to eat clean. That was what I was telling myself. I didn't know why. I didn't know what I was going to try and be at the end of it, but I just knew I needed to start this. And when I started it and I followed every social media guideline I could find, I looked, looked into the deepest and darkest points of Instagram and Facebook and you name it to find what I now see as the most ridiculous suggestions I've ever come across. But at the time thought they were God's word, literally. I, as you say, went into this obsession around the provenance of my food, the nutritional value of it, and what I believed to be appropriate. There was no dietitian telling me what was appropriate. It was what I believed from my own research. And I think that's the scary thing about it. You kind of go down this road without any training. Mm-hmm. You go down this road without any true scientific backing. And so that led me into this world of restriction. As I say, I didn't really know where I was going to go with it until I started to see the number falling on the scales. And that then became the goal. That then became the thing that I wanted to work towards. That was my driver. That was what became my friend, was that number. Because I finally started to see something objective rather than subjective. It was an absolutely objective.
Well, it felt maybe like the progress you were seeking.
Exactly. The progress to what? I don't really know. Mm-hmm. But I just know that I was managing to do something that the world was telling me was right. Losing weight was the thing you're supposed to do, according to what Facebook, Instagram, you name it, all those different things were telling. So I continued on that journey. So that's where it then moved into anorexia type program. That's where it moved to. And that's where it got really dark. Because at that point, then you are starving. You're starving your mind. You're starving your being. You are damaging it in no uncertain terms. Again, at the time, I didn't know, but I look back at it in hindsight now and I see that. It became darker in the sense that it became more obsessed. And it became something that I'm not proud of, but I know why it happened. I became the world's greatest liar. And, I lied to my partner. I lied to my parents. I lied to my friends. I lied to the world around me. I became a master Houdini, artist at being able to, engage in behaviors when no one else would know in the shortest amount of time possible to just keep myself in a certain mind frame.
Yeah. And I really appreciate you sharing that about the lying, because I think it's such a difficult part of this to talk about. There can be such guilt associated. And yet I think pushing past that guilt is in itself part of the recovery. Because, the guilt is one of the emotions that drives us with a lot of these behaviors. And we can't, allow that to remain in any sphere, I think, anyway, for me. And it is a big part of it, because you can find yourself in this place where, like we talked about earlier, the safety feels like it resides in this illness and the way that we, acted out. And therefore, being honest could be a threat to us continuing the behaviors that are making us feel safe. And so, when we delve into this, there's that logical through line. But of course, the lying comes with guilt. The behaviors come with guilt.
The only reason that I don't live with guilt about it anymore is because I know that at that moment in time, all I was doing was trying to keep myself safe. And who would give out to anyone for trying to keep themselves safe? You can't, you couldn't. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, but if someone steps away from a moving car, would you give out to them first because they kept themselves safe? You never do that. So why would you give out to someone for engaging in a behavior that they feel is keeping them safe mentally? So that's the only reason that I don't feel any guilt for it. And maybe people, might find that a little bit strange to hear, but I hope they understand that yes, I put people through a lot of pain. I put people through a lot of torture through these behaviors. But all I was doing was trying to keep myself safe. And yeah. I can't feel guilty for it.
No, I think you're spot on. It's a survival mode you get into. And so what we're surviving from is the thing that's warped, but so much of that behavior is with the best of intentions. It doesn't mean we shouldn't get the support, but it does mean we can have empathy for the horrible place that we were in.
And I think as well, the other reason I can feel quite comfortable about it is because I also recognize that it wasn't easy for other people. There can be sometimes a little bit of this, I'm going to use the word obliviousness, what is happening for your supporters around you and the people who are actually trying to help you. And you don't realize the emotional turmoil that it's causing for them as well, because you're so ingrained in it. You're so ingrained in the behaviors. You're so ingrained in the voice and what it's telling you in your head. And that's all you can hear. You're totally blind to everything else. It's like a horse with blinkers on. You can't see anything else. But now I can see what they went through. We've talked that out. We've discussed that. And I'm able to turn around to them and say, you know, how much I appreciate what they did for me, because I couldn't have done it on my own.
Yeah. They were a big part of you getting the support, right?
Massive. Coming back to where we were talking about that idea of, you know, treatment, I voluntarily went into residential treatment. So to come back from that a little bit, that gap between, you know, things getting darker and then the point of treatment, it became really dark. I was using a particular piece of software, an app on a phone, which was helping me to engage in my behaviors. And ironically, that app was what told me that I had an eating disorder. It was kind of a funny crossing of paths, let's say, but they had a blog, and on their blog, I used to follow it for recipes, this and that, all sorts of different things. And then one day they listed kind of an article on about different behaviors around food. And I think there was 8 or 9 different bullet points in it talking about different thinking that you might have or different behaviors you might have. And I had, I think, 7 or 8 of the 9. I certainly had nearly all bar one of them. And I kind of sat there in the chair and I went, whoa, what the hell does this mean? I was totally oblivious to it till then. Well, either I was oblivious or I was lying to myself. I can't really remember. But I know certainly up until that point, I didn't have an eating disorder. I read this article and I kind of went, whoa, what does this mean? 2 moments in this whole journey where I'm very proud of myself and feel comfortable to even say it. And one is this moment where I read that article and I turned to my partner, Caroline, and I said, Carol, I've just read something here, which kind of puts in sort of some sort of picture or paints some sort of picture around what's been going on for the last few months. Because, you know, I had gone to a doctor. Carolina had encouraged me to go to a doctor up until then about all this weight loss. You know, I think Carolina was maybe thinking it might have been cancer, or I was thinking it might have been something else. So we had kind of toyed around it a little bit, but without ever thinking it was an eating disorder. So that app and that blog post, which was facilitating all my behaviors, ended up being the first part of the journey to treatment, which I always find a little bit strange. I'd love to write them a letter and tell them, you know, that your product is flawed. Because it encourages these behaviors and then tells people to leave it, you know? So that was the first part. And from there, I reached out immediately to my parents because we knew we couldn't deal with this on our own. Whatever this was going to be, we couldn't deal with it on our own. So I reached out to my parents. And over the course of one weekend, things started to become a little bit more real. Things started to become a little bit more honest. Not totally honest. If I put it on a percentage level, if I was lying 100% up to that weekend, I was now lying 95%. You know, it was that's the small degrees we were dealing. So that was kind of around the end of May 2019. And so for the month of June, I then started to reach out a little bit more to see what sort of help there might be. Now, bearing in mind that this is still all being done with the eating disorder voice absolutely loud and proud inside my head. So I'm reaching out, but I'm not really reaching out. I'm half reaching out. I'm reaching out to say I've reached out, but have I really? No. And that's something that people who are supporting people with an eating disorder or any sort of mental illness need to be mindful of as well, that you cannot go in all guns blazing. You cannot go in, you know, rip that Band-Aid off straight away. It doesn't work. It has to be slow because, again, let me paint this picture to your listeners. You know, you've got your best friend standing right beside you and, you know, you're about to go on a journey, you know, the Grand National, for example, you're about to jump over all those hurdles. And if I then told you, you could only do it without your best friend, you'd turn around and go, no, absolutely not. And that's the way you treat someone with a mental illness or, you know, who's currently looking at potentially going down that road of treatment, is you are not going to take it away from them. You're going to let them figure it out themselves and you're just going to be there to support them. And that's the key trick, you know?
Yeah. Cause it's such a difficult realization of, these behaviors have been making me feel safe, but they are actually a symptom of the problem. particularly when, like you, you'd gone all that time thinking you were fine. And I'm sure coming across times when people were encouraging certain behaviors, or you were reading things online which seemed to back up the logic that there wasn't.
Exactly. I was, you know, up until that point, I was as oblivious as everyone else was, you know. Now, I say that with a small caveat that I mightn't have been completely oblivious to it, but I certainly was lying to myself. Because again, you're protecting what you're doing, you know. So for the next month, the next 4 weeks, I started reaching out to different places with the help of my partner, with the help of my parents. We started with Bodywise. I made a call to their anonymous helpline. And I have to say that was wonderful. They didn't challenge anything. They didn't tell me I was doing anything wrong. They didn't try and figure out where this was coming from. All they did was just provide a bit of a listening and comforting ear. That's all. And say, oh, you know, this is normal. This isn't totally strange. One thing I found very difficult during that period of time was trying to find anyone I could relate to. I was a 36-year-old, middle-aged, white man, heterosexual. And I say that for a specific reason, that what I could find in the media was I could find the feminine world of young girls, you know, girls maybe in their early teens into their early 20s, or, you know, then also into their, you know, middle-aged lives. And I could find homosexual men, but I couldn't find any heterosexual men that had an eating disorder. So again, that makes you start to wonder, because I'm in a heterosexual relationship, but I can't find any heterosexual men that live with this. So what, you know, am I living a bigger lie than I think about, you know, or what's going on? So that was something, and I have to be very honest in saying that. I hope people take that in the way I meet, you know, that it adds another...
No, I appreciate that. It must have been scary to be like, okay, so I'm realizing I might have some problems I didn't realize. How many realizations am I going to have, you know?
Exactly. You're kind of wondering, where is this going to stop? And, you know, I suppose that added to the fact that, you know, up until then, I didn't have kids as well, you know, so what's going on here? So that was just another part of the maelstrom at the time, let's say. So that was something I found very difficult. But I was trying to find someone that I could relate to that was of a similar demographic to me, which was difficult. But the other, even more difficult thing around that time was, imagine, again, for your listeners, I'm going to paint a picture. Imagine you are sitting in a room and you are telling someone your deepest, darkest secrets. Now, you can trust that that person won't tell anyone else, okay? So you really do open up. And you open up very emotionally, and you open up with a lot of distress. And you open up on the basis that you think they're going to help you. You think that they're going to provide some support to you, that you are taking a risk, but this is going to be of benefit. Now imagine you have to do that 14 different times. That's what I had to do over 4 weeks. Because every person that I went to either wasn't a good fit, and that's okay. I don't mind if they're not a good fit, if they don't know about eating disorders, and they don't, you know, exactly understand the treatment process, or they specialize in something. That's fine. I absolutely understand that. But where I have the real issue is when you approach someone who then tells you they're going to pass you on to someone else within their same system. And then when you get to the someone else, and they open the door and they welcome you in and they sit you down and they go, okay, well, so what's the problem? And you look at them and you go, did you not talk to the person that I just spoke to? Mm-hmm. The person that sent me to you? What happened here? Because it's torture, absolute torture, to be having to recount your inner traumas all the time. And I wasn't recounting a big trauma. I wasn't recounting physical abuse, emotional abuse, sexual abuse. That's not what it was. But I was recounting lots of mini traumas, which up to my life had got me to that point. You know, things like bullying in work, all those pressure cooker things of you know, the modern life, various other little bits and pieces. And I'm recounting all of these and I'm being really honest. I'm saying, look, I'm in such a weak position here. I feel totally unworthy. I feel totally unvalued. I need help. Then this person says, yeah, we'll give you help and I'll put you on to the right person, send you to the right person. That person doesn't know. And then you have to do it all over again.
And this is meant to be part of the reason we have diagnoses, so that it can be a shorthand of, here is the area of support this person needs.
Exactly. And so what that led me to, I'm a pretty sensible guy. I hope your listeners have picked up at this stage that I'm fairly clear. And I can kind of add things up in my head. But it got me to the point where, as a result of these, let's call them mini tortures along the way, and as well as what I didn't recognize at the time were all of the physical and mental symptoms that were building up as a result of the malnourishment. And I can talk about them in a little bit because I think it's good for people to recognize what they are. I got to the point where at the end of those 4 weeks, I was having panic attacks. I'll paint one picture. I'm sitting in a couch. My mother's sitting beside me. I'm a 36-year-old smart guy sitting on the couch. And all I'm saying is, you might have to beep this little bit out, I'm so fucking confused. And I'm shouting this out through floods of tears after a panic attack. Because I cannot understand why, number one, all of these things are happening to me, because I didn't know what the mental and physical symptoms of restriction were. Mm-hmm. And I also couldn't understand why I'm holding my hands up to everyone and, you know, surrendering myself, and no one seems to want to help me. And I'm kind of going, why am I doing this? You know, yeah. What is the purpose of all of this?
Yeah, why are you being passed around?
Falling out. Yeah, the purpose of all of this. Number one, I'm not achieving anything myself anymore because I'm more sick than I thought I was ever going to be. You know, I thought losing weight meant I was going to be great. But no, I'm actually in a really sick place. And number two, anybody that I'm asking for help is not helping. So what do I do? And I say it got to a dark place. It got to a really dark place because I started to think that, you know, there was no more. And what's really sad about that, and makes me sad when I even think about it now, is I was planning to use what was most precious to me. I was planning to use the water to take my own life. Even talking to you now, I feel all of a sudden, just as I'm talking to you, I feel a huge amount of anxiety in my body around mm-hmm. that, and a huge amount of emotion around that, because the water is very precious to me. And that idea that I was going to use another best friend to help me out of it all, basically through suicide, was sad. And that was where we then got to the point of residential treatment, because I found myself in Beaumont Hospital, again, received little to no help that night. My parents were there with me. They tried their best. Now, when I say little to no help, I actually did get some quite good advice that night. I didn't. My parents did. I was just a shell at this point. Imagine a body that just has no joie de vivre in it anymore. Literally, you know, it's just someone staring into space. So my parents and my partner were doing all of the work for me. And the one thing that the registrar did do that night, the psychiatric registrar did that night, which I think was very wise when I looked back, and that was she didn't take me into Beaumont Hospital because she was going to end up putting me into a general psychiatric ward. And she felt that wasn't going to be any good because what I was dealing with was a very specific type of mental illness, with very specific behaviors that she recognized needed to be dealt with in a very specific way. Mm-hmm. So instead of admitting me that night, she sent me home. But what it did mean was then we had to try and find some private treatment. And that was where then voluntarily, as I said, I did go in there and I signed myself in. They no one else had to sign me in, but with a lot of cajoling through my parents and my partner, did I go into a facility here in Dublin, which I committed to 2 weeks. I said, I'm going in for 2 weeks and I'm going to come out and I'm going to be fixed. No problem. And you can hear the joy in my voice and the laughter in my voice as I say it, because when I look back at it now, I realize, Jesus, what was that pain? and the funny thing is, my parents and my partner tell me nowadays that they heard me say that, but they knew.
Yeah, they probably just thought it along to get you in there.
Exactly. Let's just get him in the door. Let's just get him in there. And so they did. And so I went in, and 4 years later, I'm still engaged in therapy for, you know, the challenges that I face. And that's how long it takes, you know. So if listeners learn anything from what I've said so far, it's that you cannot, I mentioned there the idea of ripping the band-aid off. You can't do that. You know, it's really slow, really, really slow.
Yeah. Yeah. And you'd had a long, long time to learn these behaviors that then needed a long time to unlearn. And something I want to circle back on with this is, in terms of where you were at through that recovery process and therapy, and that being a big key to understanding the extent of the issues and what you needed to change, how was it trying to separate what is to do with anxiety, what's depression, what's anorexia, what's OCD?
Where they're coming from, in my case, doesn't necessarily need to be separated because they are all coming from the same place. They're just different variations of the same behavior, is what I've learned. So it's very similar in that sense that OCD, a restrictive eating disorder, anxiety, which is causing you to remove yourself from certain situations or develop certain types of thinking around being unsafe. And then depression is kind of the the adding of all of those up and pulling the covers over your head and not wanting to get out of bed because you just don't want to face it, all kind of came from the same place, which was this feeling of needing control to feel like I felt safe in the world. So when I then went into therapy and I went into, you know, different interventions around treatment, I didn't really have to separate them out because it was recognized, because the therapists I was dealing with were very good. It was recognized that these were all kind of the same thing, just in different manifestation, that's all. So, you know, at different times, while it might have looked like they were dealing with an eating disorder behavior, in fact, what maybe the nurse who was dealing with me at the time was doing was actually dealing with anxiety and dealing with anxious behaviors and working with me on that. I didn't recognize it at the time, but she might. Mm-hmm. Or there's been many times where I've sat in a room with people and we wouldn't be talking about anything to do with eating disorders or anything to do with OCD or anything to do with, you know, anxiety or any other particular diagnoses. We're just talking about life in general and not trying to pin it down to particular behaviors, but just talking about what are the deeper traumas that we've lived with that have caused these rashes, caused these manifestations or these behaviors. And that was something I kind of went into treatment very blind, not really knowing what was treatment. And nowadays, that's actually something I try to do a lot of work around, is opening that door into what is treatment? What is therapy? What is intervention? Because I think we use these words of, you know, oh, you know, there's no treatment beds in Ireland, or there's no treatment facilities in Ireland, or, you know, you're going to go engage in therapy. What does that actually mean? And what does that look like? If I said to you, you're going to have heart surgery tomorrow, probably an image comes into your head pretty quickly that, you know, someone lying on a bed, the chest is going to be opened up, you can see the heart beating, and there's going to be lots of blood. And it's probably pretty true to life that that's what it's going to look like. If I said to you that someone is going into treatment tomorrow, multiple different things might come into your head around what that will be. So for the person who's facing that treatment, or for the person supporting that individual, that can be quite daunting. Because you don't know what is this world that you're about to enter.
And yet, I also think there's an opportunity there of there being so many more types of treatment than we may know. You know, with how stigma still exists, with how, yes, there can be lacking of certain services, but also lack of promotion of the options that are out there. You know, I talk about it with therapy, for example. There's as many types of therapy as there are counsellors, nearly. You know, because every individual has their distinct approach, their distinct relationship they would have with you as a client. And so as we start to wrap up now, would you mind reflecting a little bit about the position you're in now and your kind of understanding of recovery in an ongoing process? You know, that you've achieved a lot, clearly, and yet that awareness is clearly so important to maintain as part of that recovery for you.
Well, the first thing I'll say is I'll hold you up on a word that you've used there, which is achieve. I don't like to think that I've achieved anything, because achieving it or challenging and achieving implies success or failure. You'll either have a successful result or you'll fail, you know, depending on how you do in your own head. And failure is a big problem. Failure is a very, very strong word in my head. So nowadays I experiment. So my treatment journey has been an experiment. Because an experiment will deliver a positive or a negative result at the end. And all you'll take from that is you'll learn for the next time you do it. So you kind of remove the potential for failure as a result. That's my belief anyway, that experiments will deliver you positive or negative learnings for the next time you go to try and do something. And that way it's just a continuous circle that keeps going for the rest of your life and doesn't set you up for a fall, which is what I did for so many years. I set myself up for fall. So that's kind of where I'm at in my world now, is that everything I'm doing, I'm trying to do with less expectation and more just experiment in the moment. You know, experiment of how right now it's going. My biggest learning has been that this is not a short process. It is a long process. And that's not a bad thing. In fact, I actually think it's great. Because I love therapy. I love treatment. I get a lot from it because I learn so much. And my value, I suppose one thing that I've learned through my, you know, therapeutic interventions is what I value, what helps me stand up You know, what gives me strength around my spine? The pillars of value that I stand for. And one of them is sharing knowledge. It's sharing experience. It's sharing knowledge. It's living in community. You know, we've turned into this really awful society of living as individuals rather than as community. You know, if you go back into the Stone Ages, we lived in tribes and it took a village to raise a child, literally. And, you know, we lived in 30, 40, 50 people groups, and we learned from everyone and we shared experiences and we were able to, you know, feed off each other and help each other and support each other. Whereas now we live as individuals in one bed apartments in high rise blocks where we don't know anyone and we don't get to meet anyone and we work from home and, you know, we have no interaction with people. So that was part of what was causing me stress, was causing me a problem in all of this. So I'm very glad now that through things like this, through meeting my therapist on a regular basis, through a lot of the group therapy that I did go through, I don't engage in that as much anymore. But even just getting out with friends and doing things, I see that as a therapeutic thing now. So I've learned that that's what I look for. You know, that's what I need in my life. And so that's why I do these types of things. And that's why I love therapy, because I get to talk, I get to share, and I get to help others, which is massively important.
Yeah, absolutely. So agree on so much of that. And on that note, then we'll wrap up there. Is there anything you want to kind of promote? Of course, there's the documentary that you were part of on RTE called Unspoken. Anything else?
So yeah, Unspoken is obviously one which recently won some awards, which we're very proud of, and is still available to view on the RTE player. And I, you know, myself, Daniel and Cormac, the three of us who took part in it, we believe it was never for us. It was never be, you know, for us to gain limelight or anything like that, but it was for us to share our stories. And we believe that Alan, who directed it, has done a really powerful job in terms of putting together a piece of work that speaks for the voice of someone with an eating disorder. It doesn't have to be a man. It could be a woman too, or a female, or whatever gender identity that you may recognize as. That's the first thing, Unspoken. Sea Change is another thing. And so I work as a Sea Change ambassador, essentially doing what I'm doing here now, talking and opening the world of, you know, opening up the world of mental health and mental illness and trying to, I suppose, destigmatize some of the language around it and some of the thinking around it. Language is the particular one for me. The power that we have in the words that we use is incredible. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, something else that I do. So if you ever have the opportunity to engage with Sea Change as an individual for your listeners, by all means do. And it can be quite helpful to, as a space to learn and understand what mental health and mental illness is, in case you are, you know, working with someone who has challenges in that world. And then a self-indulgent plug, if anyone wants to come stand-up paddleboarding, I now take people stand-up paddleboarding out in Hope in Dublin through my centre called Discover SUP. And you'll come out, you'll learn how to stand-up paddleboard, but that's only the small part. The best part is we get to talk and we get to have the chats and, you know, a bit of banter on the water. And it's a great confidence builder. And I certainly feel that's my main goal, is that someone might go on the water a little bit nervous, a little bit worried, and come off the water with a beaming smile. That's my main goal. So yeah, so that's the things to make people aware of.
Love that. Thank you. And in the bit behind the paywall, I want to ask you more about the reaction you've had to being so open in these conversations and indeed the documentary. So for now, thank you. Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.